This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Way of Health, a nonprofit health clinic emphasizing internal medicine, including special programs for mental health issues such as depression or anxiety. The Way of Health is located at the corner of Southeast Market at 106th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-788-4165.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from locally owned Spirit One Internet Services, offering reliable high-speed DSL, dial-up, web hosting, shell access, and more. For information, the number is 503-240-8200 or www.spiritone.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Fiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a report shows minimum wage workers have little chance of finding affordable housing in Oregon.
The Senate blocked oil drilling in Alaska's wildlife refuge today.
And Elton John and David Furnish were among hundreds of same-sex couples to tie the knot in England and Wales today, capping a first week of legalized civil unions in the United Kingdom.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,158 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 42,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,088 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 21, 2005. I'm Spencer Raymond.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. This past weekend, hundreds of Santas rampaged, peacefully though, through downtown and northwest Portland. KBOO's Andy Seaton was there and has this story.
This past Saturday, 250 Santas roamed through downtown and northwest Portland in the 10th annual SantaCon. This followed SantaCons in Vancouver, Canada 2 weeks ago and Seattle last week. The Santas spent the afternoon handing out toys, singing Christmas carols, visiting bars and strip clubs, and otherwise liberally spreading holiday cheer. They met up at noon at Saturday Market under the Burnside Bridge. Men and women were dressed as various Santas, a Jesus or two, and even a reindeer.
Howdy! My name's Rhonda. Rhonda the redneck reindeer. Problem with Rudolph is he don't know how to party. You know what I'm saying? Yeehaw!
The Santas were a surprisingly peaceful bunch. They were following four basic rules.
Don't f*** with the police. If you want to get arrested, don't do it while you and I are dressed the same. Don't f*** with store security. Whatever they tell you to do, do it. Don't f*** with little kids. They're tormented enough in this society as it is. We don't need to add to their therapy sessions in the future. And don't f*** with me or I'll puke on your suit, you damn imposter.
Santa brought toys for both children and adults.
If you want to distribute gift these to kids, they're in the white bags. For adults, in the black bags. Be very, very careful. Do not mix up the two or Santa might get a visit from the authorities.
After visiting Saturday Market, they moved on to their first stop, the Cabaret Club. The dancers there said Santa was a very good tipper, although one was upset that Santa was taking too many holiday pictures. Santa then visited Riverfront Park, where they sang carols and played reindeer games. They tossed Christmas trees and catapulted fruitcakes. From there, some of the Santas tried to visit Meyer and Frank's. However, the holiday spirit was particularly lacking there. Meyer and Frank's staff banned them from entering Santaland. They even stopped Santa from handing out toys to children.
Merry Christmas!
You want a toy? I'm sorry, we can't pass that face right now.
Okay.
Not letting this lack of spirit get them down, they moved on. They visited Powell's Books to spread more cheer. But the holiday spirit of Powell's staff was also a little lacking. What do you think of all of this?
I don't think. It's Christmas, and I'm in retail.
The Santas attracted a police escort of three bike cops. But they gave Santa a good, if terse, report.
How's it going so far?
Good.
No arrests?
None.
Are they being mostly peaceful?
Yeah, for the most part.
After a peaceful stop at the Eagle Gay Bar and the neighboring Ringler's Bar and Grill, Santa again ran into trouble. They were almost immediately kicked out of the Fantasy Adult Superstore. The reason for this corporate bah humbuggery was not immediately apparent. Santa took it all in stride and moved on to the Gypsy in Northwest for an extended visit. One of the northern elves said how easy it was to herd these 250 Santas around Portland.
All I have to do is point them in a direction and say, go that way. And it works.
Amazing.
I can't believe it myself.
Many Santas relaxed and reflected on the spirit of SantaCon.
The spirit of SantaCon is for everybody here to have fun, get loaded, and sing songs and be silly together, and come together once a year to have a lot of fun.
Santa continued spreading holiday cheer until the bars closed. And I'd like to wish you all an enjoyable celebration of your chosen winter observances. Until next year, I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
Craig Berkman, former Oregon Republican Party chairman, has been accused by more than 50 investors in three of his venture capital funds of fraud and misappropriating $33.5 million. In a lawsuit filed yesterday in Multnomah County Circuit Court, the investors accused Berkman of running a complex fraud by using millions of dollars they invested in his funds to repay pre-existing debts. Berkman also put much of their money into companies Berkman controlled or had a significant personal interest in without disclosing the conflict of interest, the lawsuit alleged. Berkman, who ran unsuccessfully for his party's gubernatorial nomination in 1994, declined to comment. Some of Portland's wealthiest businessmen put money into the three Berkman funds, among them former lumberman Peter Scott, Peter Bricks, former owner of Bricks Maritime, and real estate investor Jordan Snitcher. Lewis and Clark College gave Berkman $1.5 million, but the largest single investor, with about $50 million, was the British Columbia Investment Management Corp., the province's $62 billion public pension fund.
The head of Portland's police union said yesterday that if the city council placed pension reform on the ballot for voters to decide, the union would defeat it at any cost. Robert King, president of the Portland Police Association, attacked a citizen committee's recommendation to dismantle the $87 million a year system that provides pension and disability payments to about 3,300 active and retired city police and firefighters. It is the only pay-as-you-go pension and disability plan in the country, meaning that the money comes straight from Portland residents' property taxes. Commissioner Dan Saltzman, who said he expected union opposition, is pressing for a nay vote, confident he'll get the three votes he needs on the council to send reforms to voters. They said they have too many unanswered questions and are wary about Saltzman's timeline. The comments came after the Independent Review Committee, a nine-member citizen group that spent nearly 50 hours over 9 months studying the Public Safety Fund, presented its inch-thick report to the council.
It's the first day of winter, and that's a cold reminder for the thousands of Oregon families who can't afford to pay to keep a roof over their heads. A recent report shows minimum wage workers have little chance of finding affordable housing in Oregon. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside reports.
Wednesday is the first day of winter, and for many Oregon families, including thousands of children, the winter cold is even more cruel because they find themselves without a place to live. A report released this month from the National Low Income Housing Coalition shows a low-wage worker in Oregon has a little chance of finding affordable housing. Martha McLennan with Northwest Housing Alternatives says that leaves almost 2,000 kids in Clackamas County alone homeless.
It's critical for the livability of Oregon to continue for us to be able to provide for people that cannot keep up with these prices.
The fair market average rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Oregon is $682 a month. When utilities are included, Oregonians earning the minimum wage would have to work two jobs to pay the bills.
Portlanders haven't seen a ghetto yet, and that's the path that Portland's going to take if there isn't any funding for housing. You're talking about a very small sum of money that in the long term is going to benefit all of us in the state.
Content was provided by Oregon News Service. I'm Sheila Whiteside, KBOO News.
Funding remains the main question for a proposed steel arch marking the 45th parallel, the halfway point between the equator and the North Pole. The arch, topped by a blue globe, will stretch over River Road in Kaiser. Estimates put the cost of the arch at $80,000. The city council will hear a proposal next month whether to use public funds to help pay for it. So far, the Kaiser Chamber of Commerce has raised about $6,000 in donations. Members would like the arch built in time for the Iris Festival in May. They'd like help paying the arch designer to get the project off the ground in case donations fall short. ¶¶ The current time is 5:10. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee has begun a process that could lead to the censure and perhaps the impeachment of the President and Vice President. Craig Holcomb has completed his goal of running 50 marathons in 50 states after 50 weeks. And the International Monetary Fund today gave approval of debt relief for 19 of the world's poorest countries. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River. In the Senate, Democrats successfully upheld a filibuster against a Pentagon spending bill that had contained the provision to allow drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. Meanwhile, Vice President Dick Cheney canceled his trip to Saudi Arabia and Egypt to cast a tie-breaking vote in the Senate that cuts $40 billion from the budget, mostly from programs for the poor. Also, as the Senate attempts to end the session this year, negotiators are still appear to be far apart on reauthorizing the Patriot Act. 16 of the most controversial measures expire in less than 2 weeks. FSRN's Mitch Jezeris has the wrap-up of all the recent action in the U.S. Senate.
Environmental lobbyists huddled outside of the Senate chamber listening to a vote that would try to break a filibuster on the defense appropriation bill that contains an amendment to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. They celebrated when it was announced that the GOP leadership came up 3 votes short. It could be argued that this year was the closest in the 25-year struggle that the measure actually passed. Anna Rio with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group was one of the people waiting outside the U.S. Senate chamber.
But if this holds, it's a very good day for the American public and for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Now, this year, it came some kind of close. It had passed both the Senate and the House earlier in
the
year.
Well, you know, Senator Stevens pulled out all the stops and really did some stuff that was totally untowards and totally wrong. And I think this vote shows how bad and wrong his judgment was.
You think you'll be back here next year on the same issue?
You know what? It's not over till it's over. So.
Senator Stevens has promised to quit every time he's lost this one. We're expecting him to honor his word.
So you expect him to come back again with this?
Yeah, we've been fighting the Arctic for 20-some years. Yes, I do expect him to come back on this.
What's your name?
Marty Hayden. I'm with Earth Justice.
Republican Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska has been trying for 25 years to open up ANWR to oil drilling, and he's likely to try again next year.
Mr. President, I hope the good Lord will help me hold my temper, and I think that will be the case.
In a controversial move, Stevens attached the ANWR provision to the defense appropriation measure, which in Washington is considered to be a must-pass bill because it's seen as money for the troops. It's also money for such defense contractors as Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman. The measure also contains an additional $50 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Stevens threatened the Democrats that if ANWR was not made part of the final measure, funds for a heating assistance program for the elderly and the poor would also be stripped out.
Part of the income from ANWR is dedicated to home heating. The bill provides $2 billion in emergency money. Yes, I said emergency for 06 in this bill. Now, if you take out ANWR, you take out that money. If you take out that money, you don't have money for LIHEAP this year other than what's in the bill that just passed, and that's what was available last year. And as we all know, the price of energy has gone up.
As of airtime, the Senate had not voted on a defense appropriation bill without ANWR. The Senate is also deadlocked on the Patriot Act reauthorization bill that would make permanent or extend 16 of the most controversial provisions. The Senate successfully filibustered the bill last week, and with the provisions less than 2 weeks away from expiring, President Bush says he won't sign a 3-month extension. Free Speech Radio News spoke with one of the Senate Republicans blocking a vote on the bill, Larry Craig of Idaho.
Obviously, he, like we, want the Patriot Act in place. It's never been an issue, at least with us, of killing it. It's improving it, refining it, making sure the firewalls are down and all parties are communicating, but also not giving extraordinary powers to our government unless there are some safeguards and some checks in there. that protect our civil liberties. So we are working it. It's still active as long as we're in session. We'll see where we can get.
So if you don't let the 16 provisions expire, then it seems like one side's going to have to break. Is it possible that we get near December 31st and maybe you would consider a change in your position right now in the current?
Well, it's probably a situation where both sides will blink a little, but all sides are going to have to.
Mitch Cheserich, Free Speech Radio News, The Capitol.
The ACLU has released documents obtained from a Freedom of Information suit that shows federal law enforcement officers put several activist groups under surveillance in the wake of the September 11th attacks. Included in the list of groups that underwent special scrutiny was an animal rights group, a Catholic social work organization, and a group that advocates for the rights of Arab Americans. The California Report's Judy Campbell has more on the fallout from the release of these papers.
Jeff Dietrich has spent 35 years with the Los Angeles Catholic Workers on Hollywood's Skid Row.
We do the work of Jesus Christ. We feed the hungry, clothe the naked, shelter the homeless.
In 2001, Dietrich and others were arrested after trespassing at Vandenberg Air Force Base in a semi-annual protest of the nation's missile defense system. FBI counterterrorism documents say any trespass that might delay a missile test launch would cost at least $1 million and damage the public image of the defense system. Ben Weiser is the ACLU attorney who sued for the documents.
No one is making the argument that these groups should be immune from any law enforcement scrutiny. But the question is, should counterterrorism resources be devoted to doing that, and should these groups have to bear the label of domestic terrorists because of their ideology?
The FBI documents reveal surveillance of mainstream organizations such as Greenpeace and refer to a list of participants at a Stanford conference on Iraq. The Catholic Workers' Dietrich says he finds it all frightening.
I'll tell you what I feel is, at a certain point, if there's another terrorist attack, then people like me who are basically nonviolent but critical of government policy run the risk of being rounded up or at least hounded. That's my deepest fear.
The FBI didn't respond to a request for an interview, but in a statement, the agency says surveillance was conducted only as part of a criminal or terrorism investigation and is always predicated on specific information. The FBI documents were released a week after NBC News revealed a Pentagon database that kept tabs on anti-war groups and called the UC Santa Cruz group's plan to protest military recruiters on campus a credible threat. For the California Report, I'm Judy Campbell.
President Bush's decision to bypass court review and authorize domestic wiretapping by executive order was part of a concerted effort to rebuild presidential powers weakened in the 1970s as a result of the Watergate scandal and the Vietnam War, Vice President Dick Cheney said yesterday. Returning from a trip to the Middle East, Cheney said that threats facing the country required that the president's authority under the Constitution be, quote, unimpaired. On Capitol Hill, calls for a congressional investigation have escalated, with a group of Democrats and Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee asking to join hearings scheduled by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Barbara Boxer, a California Democrat, said she had written to several constitutional scholars to ask whether Bush had committed an impeachable offense by ordering the National Security Agency in 2002 to engage in surveillance within the United States without a court order.
A federal judge has resigned from the court that oversees government surveillance and intelligence cases in protest of President Bush's secret authorization of a domestic spying program, according to two sources. U.S. District Judge James Robertson, one of 11 members of the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, sent a letter to Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. late Monday, notifying him of his resignation without providing any explanation. Two associates familiar with his decision said yesterday that Robertson privately expressed deep concern that the warrantless surveillance program authorized by the president in 2001 was legally questionable and may have tainted the FISA court's work. Word of Robertson's resignation came as two Senate Republicans joined the call for congressional investigations into the National Security Agency's warrantless interception of telephone calls and emails to overseas locations by U.S. citizens suspected of links to terrorist groups. They questioned the legality of the operation and the extent to which the White House kept Congress informed. The hearings would occur at the start of a midterm election year, during which the prosecution of the Iraq War could figure prominently in House and Senate races.
As President Bush and his aides scrambled to explain new revelations regarding Bush's authorization of spying on the international telephone calls and emails of Americans, the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee has begun a process that could lead to the censure and perhaps the impeachment
of the president and the vice president. U.S. Representative John Conyers, the Michigan Democrat who was a critical player in the Watergate and Iran-Contra investigations into presidential wrongdoing, has introduced a package of resolutions that would censure President Bush and Vice President Cheney and create a select committee to investigate the administration's possible crimes and make recommendations regarding grounds for impeachment. The Conyers resolution adds a significant new twist to the debate on how to hold the administration to account for its actions. Even Republicans, including Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter, are talking about, for the first time, about mounting potentially serious investigations into abuses of power by the president. Months of suspense end today as the Department of Energy announces who will manage Los Alamos National Laboratory, the University of California or the University of Texas. The California Report's Cy Musiker reports.
The University of California has managed Los Alamos for the Department of Energy since World War II, but the department opened the contract to other bidders after a series of embarrassing scandals at the lab.
Win or lose, there are going to be some major changes at Los Alamos.
UC Professor George Blumenthal, he's immediate past chair of the Academic Senate. Blumenthal notes the UC and its sole competitor, the University of Texas, have both allied themselves with major defense contractors to strengthen the bids. The UC with Bechtel, the University of Texas with Lockheed.
No matter what happens, it will no longer be run by the University of California. It'll be run by a limited liability company.
Many lab watchers think the University of Texas and Lockheed have made the stronger bid. Among them, Doug Roberts, who spent 20 years at Los Alamos. Now he maintains a blog that tracks news at the lab. He says Los Alamos employees are eager to hear who they'll be working for.
It will be received with great relief by most of the people involved because they're just tired of having this decision hanging over their heads.
Managing Los Alamos isn't just about academic prestige. The Department of Energy's decision could also suggest whether the UC will be allowed to continue managing Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. Many think the department will want to keep both nuclear facilities under the same management for security reasons. For the California Report, I'm Cy Musiker.
19 states will miss the January 1 deadline for complying with the federal law ensuring accurate and honest elections, but most should be ready when votes are cast in November 2006. The National Association of Secretaries of State surveyed the states on compliance with the 2002 law that helps or requires states to replace outdated voting equipment, establish statewide voter registration databases, require better voter identification, and provide provisional ballots so qualified voters can make their choices. The association found that 23 states will be in compliance with the Help America Vote Act, the law that emerged from the disputed 2000 presidential election, marked by hanging chads, butterfly ballots, and accusations of uncounted votes. The 19 states that will miss the January 1 deadline cited problems completing the voter registration database or getting voter equipment in place, or both. Only two states said they wouldn't be ready with completed databases in time for the 2006 elections, and 42 states said they would have the required election equipment for next year's elections. Congress has provided some $3.9 billion to states to comply with the law. 23 said they would meet the January 1 deadline, in part because they had already had a voter database system or the necessary equipment. The city and state stepped up their pressure on striking transit workers today in hopes of forcing them back to work, and a judge said sending union leaders to jail was a distinct possibility. State Supreme Court Justice Theodore Jones, who is hearing several legal issues related to the strike, directed attorneys from the Transport Workers Union to bring other president and top officials before the court tomorrow to answer to a criminal contempt charge. He said he may sentence the union leaders to jail for refusing to end the strike. The possibility of jail time for union leaders was one of several developments today as millions of New Yorkers made their way to work in another bone-chilling commute without subways or buses. Yesterday, Jones imposed a huge fine against the Transport Workers Union, $1 million for each day of the strike. The fine could deplete the union's treasury in a matter of days. The union vowed to immediately appeal. The infrastructure of New Orleans, both natural and human-made, has been stretched beyond the breaking point. This includes the court system, which was physically displaced and now operates with a workforce decimated by budget cuts. FSRN Melinda Tuhus sat on a recent morning session of a municipal court where some say justice has taken a big hit.
Almost 60 people were processed through Judge John Shea's courtroom in 90 minutes. They were charged with various misdemeanors, such as public intoxication, trespassing, and curfew violations. The public defender representing 50 of the accused who had spent the night in jail spoke to them as a group for a couple of minutes. He told them what they should expect if they pleaded guilty or not guilty. All but a handful pleaded guilty and had to pay a $200 or $300 fine. One of them was Larry Reed, a middle-aged African-American man who was arrested for violating the 6 a.m. curfew by a half hour. Some family members were in court to pay his fine. His cousin Doris Brown was outraged.
Say he was going down there where they look for work at, you know, hiring people to clean out houses and things. So I still can't understand why he had to pay the $200 for that length of time. Nobody has no money.
She says her family was in the Superdome and then shuffled around the country before returning to New Orleans.
Nobody has no money. Then we got to take your Social Security money and pay for a fine. That's unfair.
Judge Shea says before Hurricane Katrina, all the municipal courts together processed 90,000 cases a year. The numbers are much lower now because so many residents have not yet returned to the city. But Shea says the court still has to maintain law and order.
If they don't do this now, then it's going to just get out of hand. So the police feel that they have an obligation to enforce these kind of laws.
Public defender Norman Pettengill has worked with the Indigent Defender Program for the city of New Orleans since it was set up in 1971. He says it's frustrating work.
More and more people we have to represent and less time to do it, and it's getting a lot tougher, less resources, because nobody likes to give money to people who are charged with crimes. They forget about the little philosophy that they're innocent until proven guilty.
But New Orleans attorney Judson Mitchell says the court system is more than frustrating. It's corrupt, funding its operations by preying on poor people who have returned to New Orleans to work.
The court is more than happy to let them loose immediately upon them agreeing to pay a $300 fine within 48 hours, which they all do, regardless of whether or not they're guilty or not, because they need to get back out and get working to get money in their pockets and to rebuild our city. I hope this is not the way we want to start again. We've had a chance to rebuild, to renew.
Mitchell adds,
let's start by making our courts a little bit more honest.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Orleans.
Good news if you like hot stuff. Two Dickinson State University students are attempting to create a fast-growing and prolific new species of pepper. Three times a week, Dana Ely and Jennifer Robinette manage the university's greenhouse as investigators in a botany experiment called the Pepper Project. The women, both seniors, seeded 160 pepper plants on September 30th. The project involves two different crossbreeds so the students can compare the groups. One group was bred with the pollen from the hot wax placed on the pistil of the red sweet pepper. The second group was bred with the pollen from the red sweet and placed on the pistil of the hot wax pepper. Although the peppers may have hybrid traits after the first generation, the project aims to look at the second generation where the traits will become more prevalent. Ellie and Robinette record the ambient temperature of the greenhouse, the average soil temperature, the average length of the pepper plant, and maturation of each plant. They also water them. If the pepper project is a success, the students will not sell the seeds commercially. They said the peppers are meant to be given to people like backyard gardeners. The students hope to present their results at various stages to the North Dakota Academy of Science and North Dakota State University.
Tired of the runaround at his corporate job, Craig Holcomb opted for another kind of foot race. Holcomb left his job as the chief financial officer at Little Tykes, sold his home, and spent the past year on the road with his dog Tonka, pursuing a goal of completing 50 marathons in 50 states. Holcomb has completed his goal after 50 weeks. The running started January 2nd in Mobile, Alabama, and ended Sunday in South Carolina. He ran 48 marathons and two ultra marathons in all. The 38-year-old found that logistics were a challenge. A couple of the marathons he entered were canceled, and some had lotteries that he didn't win. There were five weekends he didn't run, forcing him to run back-to-back marathons five times. He ran most of the marathons in 4 hours, and although he was focused mainly on finishing, he won two, one in South Dakota and one in Kentucky. Holcomb ran some races hurt after injuring his knee earlier in the year and his hip during the summer. He limped through about 10 miles of the race, of one race. He said, quote, I haven't discovered a cure for blisters.
The current time is 5:29, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
All hail Halliburton, emperor of pork barrel spending. Render unto Halliburton what is Halliburton's. All kneel. Good grief. Is there no end to how cozy the Bushite regime will get with this avaricious military mooch? We know that Dick Cheney's former company is getting fat on special insider no-bid contracts from the Bush-Cheney government, including sweetheart deals that reach from Iraq to New Orleans. And we've learned that Halliburton, which continues to pay Cheney more than $150,000 a year, has been caught overcharging American taxpayers on oil contracts in Iraq, as well as caught serving spoiled food to our soldiers there. But hasn't the Bush-Cheney-Halliburton coziness reached a level of perverse discomfort when the corporation demands and gets a bonus of $38 million on its overcharges to us taxpayers? Yes, bonus! One of Halliburton's no-bid contracts with the Pentagon goes by the code name of RIO, Restore Iraqi Oil. It turned out to be a river of ill-gotten gain for the corporation. The Pentagon's auditors reviewed the work and declared that $169 million of the costs billed by Halliburton to Uncle Sam were either unreasonable or unsupported. Despite this official finding of corporate gouging, Pentagon higher-ups nevertheless paid the bulk of the company's unreasonable and unsupported billings, including $38 million in bonus payments to the shifty contractor. The Bushites have offered no explanation for their decision to shower such generosity on their favorite corporation. This is the same administration demanding that Congress get serious about cutting unnecessary spending, a challenge being met by cuts in food stamps, health care, child care, and other programs to help poor people. This is Jim Hightower saying, for a summary of the Pentagon's unceasing favoritism toward Halliburton, check this website, HalliburtonWatch.org. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Circle A Radio. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather, look for occasional rain with lows in the lower 40s. And tomorrow, rain, highs 45 to 50. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River. Sunni leaders alleged that rampant fraud marginalized their supporters in the Iraq elections, as officials released preliminary tallies that indicate religious Shiites will continue to dominate Iraq's government. FSRN's David Enders has more.
The Iraqi Election Commission, while saying it is investigating complaints of voter fraud, continues to deny any widespread vote tampering took place. That has not satisfied Adnan al-Dulaimi and Saleh Mutluk, the heads of the two Sunni parties that appear to have done best in the election. Preliminary vote tallies suggest the alliance of conservative Shiite politicians that did best in January's national elections will once again have the parliament's largest bloc. Though the initial voting totals appear to reflect what are often accepted as the demographics of Iraq, many Sunnis actually believe their sect constitutes as much as 60% of the population. Mustafa al-Hiti is one of the members of Mutluk's party who will have a seat in the new parliament. Hiti admits, however, that he does not expect any concessions from the Election Commission, and that the issue will cause a widening in Iraq's strife. Sunnis and secularists are greatly afraid of a conservative Shiite-dominated government like the one that has been in power since April. The newly elected government is to sit for 4 years.
There will be no Iraq after 4 years, because nobody is going to sit and just be quiet and good boy. The situation is going to be more complicated, more crisis is going to be in Iraq. So everywhere there will be a chaos.
Sadi Asadi is a political science professor at Baghdad University.
The democracy is not the election. It is the quality of rights, equality of opportunity, and equality of treatment. This is the democracy we needed in Iraq. But election is just a joke.
For their part, conservative Shiite parties have accused the U.S. government of tampering with the results of January's national elections, in which they took roughly 51% of the vote, and say that the results of last week's elections are accurate. In Amman, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Reducing the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan will not weaken the campaign against Taliban fighters and Al-Qaeda terrorists who still threaten the war-torn country, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announced today. Yesterday, he announced that the size of the U.S. force in Afghanistan will shrink from about 19,000 currently to about 16,000 by next summer. There are now about 26,800 soldiers in the Afghan National Army and about 55,000 National Police. Rumsfeld said the remaining U.S. troops could continue to help train and equip the Afghan security forces and also will work with NATO on a variety of security projects. Rumsfeld has said that this was his 10th visit to Afghanistan since the U.S.-led invasion in October 2001 that ousted the Taliban regime. More than 4 years later, U.S. forces still have not captured al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, who used Afghanistan as a base before the U.S. invasion.
Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas's aides talked openly today about the possibility of postponing January 25th's parliamentary elections that pit the ruling Fatah party against the increasingly popular Islamic militant group Hamas. The aides cited Israel's threat to ban voting in Jerusalem for the potential delay, denying that it was merely an excuse to put off what could be a trouncing at the polls. Postponing or even canceling the elections could serve the interests of Abbas and the Israelis, but both sides dismissed speculation that they were in it together. In Gaza, Palestinian gunmen released two teachers, a Dutchman and an Australian, shortly after abducting them on their way to school today, the latest in a rash of bloodless kidnappings that have helped undermine Abbas. Hamas, entering a parliamentary race for the first time, expects to capitalize on Abbas's inept rule and the internal bickering that has split his Fatah party. Israel is alarmed at the possibility that Hamas could do well in the voting or even win. Israeli officials said that unlike past elections, the 200,000 Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem would not be allowed to vote, part of Israel's objection to Hamas's taking part in the elections.
Court sentenced more than 40 people to between 12 and 20 years in prison today in connection with the May uprising in the eastern Uzbekistan city of Adjan, which was brutally suppressed by government troops. The Interfax news agency said that two Tashkent courts convicted 42 people on charges including participation in terrorist acts and deliberate aggravated murder. The May 13 uprising erupted when militants seized a prison and freed 23 businessmen on trial for alleged Islamic extremism. The attacks also seized a local administration building and took hostages as thousands of demonstrators gathered nearby to press economic and social grievances. Rights groups and witnesses said hundreds of civilians were killed in the government crackdown. The government, however, blamed it on Islamic militants and said that just 187 people died. President Islam Karimov government refused international calls for an independent inquiry of the events following U.S. criticism and evicted U.S. military forces from a base.
Thousands of people marched to the Plaza de Mayo in Buenos Aires to mark the fourth anniversary of the popular uprising that swept away the government there. Marchers remembered the 33 people killed in that uprising and to continue their voice, their demands for social change. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
Argentina's crisis climaxed December 19th and 20th, 2001, after popular protests ousted former President De La Rúa. Masses of people swept the streets in 2001 with the slogan, Que se vayan todos, all of them out. 2 days of rebellion and an imposed state of siege ended with 33 deaths and 200 injured. Riots consumed the streets as citizens responded to a peso devaluation, frozen bank accounts, and IMF-imposed austerity measures. According to Joaquin Gutierrez, a labor organizer at the Azusa International Airport, the majority of Argentina's population have not benefited from the alleged economic recovery since the financial meltdown in 2001.
Para la gente, en la realidad, no hay grandes cambios. O sea, sigue la misma.
For the people, there haven't been any changes. They live the same injustices, the same poverty. Even though the government releases positive statistics about macroeconomic growth, what you see in the streets and in the barrios are the same problems. Trigger-happy police officers killing while on duty, children dying of hunger and malnutrition. What December 20th marks is that together we can reach social change.
Today, unemployment stands at 19.5% and underemployment 16%. Which means that roughly over 5 million workers don't have enough work. The average salary is roughly the equivalent of $200 per month. Leandro Roisman, who participates in a neighborhood assembly in Buenos Aires, said that they will cut budgets for welfare, education, and health in order to cancel the debt with the IMF. The Peronist leader is the first president to strike a deal for debt forgiveness in Argentina's history.
Sí, el pago de la deuda es realmente indignante porque no solo que
paying the foreign debt is infuriating. They are paying the IMF at the cost of hunger, unemployment, and the lack of education and health. Not only that, they're legitimizing an illegitimate debt where courts have declared the debt illegal, but they still pay it. And everyone applauds the decision as if it was the achievement of the century. People are continuing to die of hunger. Schools are crumbling and hospitals don't have proper resources.
The government announced yesterday they will pay the $10 billion debt before January 2nd. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Chagona in Buenos Aires.
Nearly complete official voting returns today showed COCA activist Evo Morales winning Bolivia's presidency, getting 54.2% of the vote, with more than 92% of the polling places tallied. Morales needed just over 50% to win outright and avoid the formality of Congress deciding between him and the man who finished a distant second, Jorge Quiroga. The Electoral Court said turnout had averaged almost 85%, much higher than in previous Bolivian elections. Morales would be the first president since Bolivia returned to a democratic rule in 1982 to be directly elected at the ballot box with no need for Congress to choose. He would also be Bolivia's first Indian president, making a historic turning point in a country traditionally governed by the non-Indian elite. Morales has said he would turn over, quote, vacant, unprotected land to poor farmers and expand Indian rights while increasing state control of Bolivia's vast national gas reserves. Morales has added that he welcomes good relations with the United States, but vowed ties with Washington would not be a, quote, relationship of submission.
Colombia's government and the nation's second-largest rebel group ended nearly a week of cordial talks in Cuba today with an agreement to set an agenda for formal peace negotiations, a move both sides called significant. Colombia's triangular conflict involving government troops, leftist rebels, and right-wing paramilitary fighters kills more than 3,000 people each year, most of them civilians. Many Colombians are clamoring for peace ahead of elections next year, in which President Álvaro Uribe is up for re-election. Uribe has led a 3-year military offensive against rebel forces since taking office, but has recently softened his approach after brokering a peace deal with the country's main paramilitary group. The current talks with the ELN mark the Uribe administration's first formal negotiations with insurgents. Several informal talks between the Colombian government and the ELN have failed since 1998. When Cuba last hosted Colombia's talks with the ELN in 2002, then-President Andrés Pastrana pulled out, saying the rebel group was not interested in peace.
Members of a banned pro-democracy group are on trial in Africa's last remaining absolute monarchy. FSRN's Naim Gina has the story.
9 members of the banned Swaziland opposition group, the People's United Democratic Movement, or PUDEMO, were yesterday remanded in custody after a court appearance related to a spate of bombings. The tiny country, surrounded by South Africa and Mozambique, is Africa's last absolute monarchy. Arrested over the weekend, the activists are accused of bombing courthouses and the houses of 3 policemen and 2 government officials. Charges include attempted murder. There is growing frustration in the impoverished country. In 1973, Swazi King Sobhuza II banned political parties, and the AIDS-ridden country has been ruled by royal decree since. A new constitution is due to come into effect next month. It strengthens human rights, but entrenches the power of King Mswati III. PUDEMO has denied any involvement in the bombings, but warns that there will be more explosions. The opposition group is calling for multi-party democracy and insists the new constitution be subjected to a referendum. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Naim Gina in Johannesburg.
The loser of Liberia's first post-war presidential elections dropped his legal challenge to the results today, saying he would accept the outcome in the interest of national reconciliation. Former soccer superstar George Weah said he decided not to take his allegations of vote tampering to the Supreme Court, clearing the way for the January 16th inauguration of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as Africa's first elected female president. On Wednesday, he sounded a conciliatory note, pleading for peace in a country still reeling from a brutal 1989 through 2003 civil war that left 200,000 civilians dead. The National Election Commission already ruled his fraud claims were unfounded.
The International Monetary Fund today gave approval for $3.3 billion of debt relief for 19 of the world's poorest countries and predicted that a 20th nation, Mauritania, would qualify for the relief in a matter of weeks. The decision by the IMF's executive board followed a campaign by debt relief advocates who were concerned that their approval of six countries might be delayed because the IMF would rule those nations had not met requirements for the relief. The IMF debt relief was part of a larger package that won the endorsement of President Bush and other world leaders at the annual Group of Eight Economic Summit last July. The agreement forgives the poorest country debts to the IMF, the World Bank, and the African Development Bank. Debt relief groups said the six countries facing delays of their relief included Mauritania, Ethiopia, Madagascar, Nicaragua, Rwanda, and Senegal. According to newly released declassified documents, the British government knowingly lied about Indonesian atrocities in East Timor in the 1970s. It was also involved in a cover-up about the murder of five journalists who were filming there, two of them British citizens. Their film would have exposed the Indonesian invasion of East Timor to the rest of the world. From London, FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports.
30 years ago, five journalists were killed by Indonesian troops in the course of filming an invasion of East Timor. That invasion was being denied by Indonesia and by Indonesia's good friends Australia, the UK and the United States. Maureen Tolfrey is the sister of Brian Peters, one of the journalists.
Brian was killed first, which in a way it's a good thing, but then again I always had nightmares really burning the bodies while they were not completely dead. I didn't hear anything for a couple of days. I broke my telephone because I was in such shock. I had no help whatsoever from Australia government or the British government. I was told there was nothing I could do or say to help in the matter. It was a tragic accident. And they were all killed in a house that was hit by mortar shell. One was killed by a stray bullet.
But what the British and Australian governments had told Maureen was simply not true. Campaigners have gathered witness reports that suggest the five journalists were executed by Indonesian troops. Classified documents they've obtained also show Australian and British governments colluded in covering up the killings and the fact the invasion was happening.
This was a blatant act of invasion, of aggression, against a country with which Indonesia had no formal relationship at all, so it was a breach of international law. Now, the international community should have strongly condemned this as an act of aggression, but they didn't do that. They didn't do that because they saw Indonesia as an important country with whom they wanted to do business and with which they wanted to invest.
Carmel Budiarjo of the Indonesia Human Rights Campaign.
One part of Indonesia, which is called West Papua, is extremely rich in natural resources. Now the company, British company BP, is developing huge investments in West Papua in the liquefied natural gas. West Papua has gold, it has nickel, it has copper, they have oil.
Not only was Indonesia rich in resources, but it was also seen as a valuable anti-communist partner in the Cold War.
The present British government should demonstrate that it's handled differently now by releasing all of the relevant documents that they have got on file about the incidents that took place during the invasion of East Timor by Indonesia towards the end of 1975.
Liberal Democrat Member of Parliament Don Foster has pressured the British government for years as part of the campaign for a judicial inquiry into the deaths of the journalists.
The evidence is that they are trying to continue a cover-up that clearly happened by the then government and the then Foreign and Commonwealth Office back in 1975. We're getting the same obscurantist approach, the same blanket out of information approach that we had back in 1975.
Maureen Tolfrey is still hoping to locate and test the remains of her brother Brian.
I went up to London so many times into the Foreign Office and I was never rude to them. I just can't trust them because they're very clever people. They say to the public that they help me, but they don't help me. But now they've got a shot coming to them because they're being subpoenaed to the coroner's inquiry.
After 30 years, a coroner's inquiry in Australia will finally be held in 2006 into the death of Maureen's brother. It's the first time all the evidence collected over the years by campaigners will be heard publicly. But back in Britain, efforts continue for further release of classified documents. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Turkmenistan's leader, who has been declared president for life, today celebrated 20 years at the helm of his gas-rich, desert Central Asian state. Mr. Niyazov came to power in 1985 when Turkmenistan was still part of the Soviet Union. Since gaining its independence in 1991, he has developed a massive personality cult. He carries the official title The Great and prefers to be called Turkmenistani, or the leader of all Turkmenians. Niyazov, who turned 66 in February, has banned all opposition in the nation of 6 million people and controls all branches of government and the media. Lawmakers declared Niyazov president for life in 1999, but he claimed he rejected the idea 2 years later and has since given several timelines for presidential polls. In a statement in October, Niyazov said the issue of next presidential election would be considered in 2009. Golden status and bust of Niyazov were scattered across the country, and his portrait on every banknote and coin. He also authored a book, Rukhnana, which sets moral guidelines for Turkmenistan and is held as a sacred text.
Britain's showbiz royalty, Elton John and David Furnish, exchanged vows and diamond wedding bands during a ceremony that capped the first week of legalized civil unions in the United Kingdom. John and Furnish were among hundreds of same-sex couples tying the knot in England and Wales today, the first day such ceremonies were possible. Others wed earlier this week in Northern Ireland and Scotland. Prime Minister Tony Blair, speaking to reporters at a news conference, congratulated the couple for exchanging their newfound legal right. Activists saw the union as a watershed moment for gay rights, a public expression of commitment that would be impossible to ignore. The new law, passed last year, allows civil ceremonies that will give same-sex couples the same social security, tax, pension, and inheritance rights as straight married couples. Several European countries have legalized same-sex unions. In the United States, though, only Massachusetts allows gay marriage, while Vermont and Connecticut permit civil unions.
Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi sent his Swedish counterpart 24 bottles of Italian wine yesterday, saying it was to help him recover from having to drink British wine at the European Union summit last week, adding, quote, up to 24 bottles is fine, more than that is corruption, end quote. Prime Minister Tony Blair hosted the summit in Brussels and offered Swedish Prime Minister Göran Persson and other guests Welsh white wine and English red wine. The Italian leader has not always been so considerate about Scandinavian taste buds. He once famously derided Finnish cooking as the Italian city of Parma battled with Helsinki for the honor of hosting a new EU food safety authority.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 21st, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Mistletoe Angel. Tonight's audio editor is Eva Hagedush. Special thanks to reporter Andy Seaton. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Spencer Raymond. Stay tuned for Independent Native News next. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News at 7:30. At 7, excuse me. And at 7:30, Joanne Bauman and Alan Graff host Talk Radio and take your calls on all kinds of topics. At 9, on the Radio Zine, Marlon Howell hosts. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's part 2 of Will Seaman's series on Israeli-Palestine. His guest is professor and radical Islami historian Ilan Pape on the Gaza evacuation. At 10:30, Portland artist Tom Kramer guest hosts Art Focus. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
Native News for Wednesday, the 21st of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The judge overseeing the Cobell versus Norton class action lawsuit has awarded $4.5 million in attorney fees to lawyers for the plaintiffs in the case. On Monday, U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth acknowledged in his ruling that the government and Department of Justice attorneys bear much of the responsibility for the costly court battle that has now lasted nearly a decade. Bill McAllister, spokesman for the plaintiffs, says the money is allocated by Congress under the Equal Access to Justice Act, which states people should not be deterred from suing the government over what they perceive as wrong just because they don't have the money to pursue a lawsuit.
In cases where the presiding judge or the ruling judge believes that there's a reasonable expectation that the complaining party will prevail, provides that the government will reimburse that party for their legal expenses. And that's what's happened in this case.
Along with the $4.5 million in attorney fees, some of which will be awarded to the lead attorney and some to the Native American Rights Fund attorneys, another $2.6 million was awarded for litigation costs and expenses. McAllister says the plaintiffs have worked for almost 10 years without receiving any compensation. The lawsuit asks the Department of Interior to account for billions of dollars from oil, gas, mining, and grazing activities on Native land. The disputed accounts date back to 1887, and one of the biggest sticking points in the case is whether or not an historical accounting can be conducted. McAllister says once that issue is resolved, the plaintiffs hope that the courts will rule on how much money is actually owed.
It would be up to the Congress to fund that amount. I think it's clearly within his power, as defined by the appeals court, to set a figure and to direct the government to take steps to make the account holders whole for their losses.
Congress has said the $27.5 billion settlement figure proposed by the plaintiffs is too high, and recent House hearings on the issue have not bridged the gap between the two parties. In other news, respite for the Oglala Sioux tribe on the Pine Ridge Reservation continues to pour in. The tribe is located in one of the poorest counties in South Dakota. Last week, we reported on the Web of Life Enterprises, an agency that has been helping the tribe for 4 years, especially as they battle high fuel prices and winter conditions. But now local agencies are also pitching in. Charles Michael Ray has more on the story.
State officials say there's 1,000 piles of wood waiting to be burned in Custer State Park alone. The wood has been cut and piled as part of the fuels reduction plan that's working to reduce the threat of forest fires. The piles would normally be burned outdoors as slash, but now several truckloads are being given to the Oglala Sioux tribe. State Wildland Fire Coordinator Joe Lowe is helping to organize the project.
We're going to take some of the piles that we have, break them down, cut them up into smaller firewood-sized lengths, and then put them in an area where the tribe can come and pick them up.
Lowe says his office feels a kinship to those on Pine Ridge because Lakota hand crews play an important role in fighting the wildfires that pop up in the Black Hills each year.
So that's why where our connection is that we are very close to those folks because of the crew members that we have.
Lowe says preliminary talks are now underway to send extra firewood to those in need on a more permanent basis. 6 semi-trailers of wood will be sent to Pine Ridge this year. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
We also have a correction. Yesterday, I falsely reported that the U.S. Senate Energy Committee recommended that drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge be included in the federal budget reconciliation bill. The correct information is that on Monday, the House Resources Committee included ANWR in the defense spending bill, not the budget reconciliation bill. I apologize for the error. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, engineers and scientists concerned with the earth. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a multi-regional, multi-tribal federal corporation serving Indian Country. Amerind-Corp.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska.